Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donnelly view system deal. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
It is Tour Live. It's Neil Atkinson. I feel like I haven't done one of these for ages, but time is just a myth at this stage of proceedings. If you listen to this as a podcast, thank you very much indeed. And you've got more to come than just, although how I dare I say just, the wonders that are Stephen Evans, Adam Smith and Sean Rogers all to join us. But as I say, if you listen to it as a podcast, I'll be speaking to Michael McCambridge about Grant Wall. And Josh is speaking to Danny Sharples about a charity gig that's being organised for an hour for others. All of that is to come. Those little bits are to come. But we will start off the four of us here present as part of Tour Live. It is on YouTube and other streaming places if you want to listen to it live. Most Fridays at 4 p.m. I am well aware of the fact that this is a Thursday at 4 p.m. But Liverpool are effectively playing a game of football tomorrow at 3:30. And whilst numbers have been down during the World Cup, the idea of doing this whilst Liverpool literally play feels like a bridge too far even for the Anfield rap. So we will chat away about World Cup related matters in the first place that is to come around what to take from the game. But there's been three big midfield links that won't go anywhere, Adam Smith. They are Jude Bellingham, Enzo Fernandez and Amrabat, Sofyan Amrabat in there as well. They are the three big midfield links. I'm struck by, first and foremost, the idea that Bellingham and Fernandez appear to be a bit more of a dual prospect than the idea of an either-or prospect, a digital prospect at this stage. What do you feel about these three links? They are obviously different flavours of links and different flavours of footballers, Adam.
Yeah, they are. That's a key thing, which is good, really good, because I think that adds credence to the idea that we might be going for all three of them rather than one or, you know, either or sort of situation, because they are three very different midfielders. Whereas normally the links, you kind of go, we're going for such and such, and if we don't get him, then such and such is there. Or, as in the case with Tchouaméni, it was a sort of, we're going for him, and there's no other links if he's not there. So I'm excited about the possibility of it being a live thing for all three of them. And I quite enjoy the way the owners are like, are you beaming about midfield, have you? Well, yeah, then we'll buy all the midfielders in one summer. Screw the lot of you. In a kind of quite fun way. And I wonder what the kind of people that hate the owners and are annoyed that they didn't buy anybody above a lot. I wonder if you'd said to them 2 years ago, well, how about we buy, you know, two of the most exciting midfielders in the world.
I mean, they've got to buy them, though, Adam, is what I would say.
Well, look, if we do, and you have that conversation, you say to the people that, you know, we've bought these two. If we buy them, you go back and say, are you now happy that we didn't buy them, any random midfielders? Because if we'd bought a random midfielder, we wouldn't have been able to buy, you know, two of the best in the world, if it happens. But I'm now sort of at the point where I'll be disappointed if it doesn't.
For both Bellingham and Fernandez.
Yeah. Like, such as the links and such as the level of where I've got to in my own head. And I've listened to shows that you've done, the one you did with Phil, the gutter that you've done this week. Didn't win an award, but it was interesting nonetheless. With Phil, where you were discussing kind of the reasoning behind.
We won't engage with that corrupt system, Adam.
Nor should you. And it's why I've never won an award. But it was really interesting, and the justification of kind of why maybe it's going to happen, the reasoning behind it all, I'm bang on board with it now, so I'm going to be fuming with you too if it doesn't.
Well, I mean, that's fair, Steve. That's the sort of thing that happens. I think it is. One of the reasons why I think it's very possible something like it happens is obviously where we expect the departures to be. And also the idea that Liverpool do pick the moments that is formed for this. They hang on for Konate when people would rather something else had happened. And they'll go from there. I'm as I say, I am actually sort of warming to the idea that this is eminently possible with Bellingham and Fernandes. Could well be proven wrong. We could all look a little bit daft. Amrabat, I'm in every single way a bit more of a skeptic about. It all feels very World Cup to me, but it could be wrong. And he is obviously playing for Fiorentina and playing at a good level. But for me, the Bellingham and Fernandes things do feel as though Liverpool will be thinking that they could, with bold moves, future-proof the midfield. And the idea of the sort of teams that have gazumped them around footballers in the past, the German journalist who spoke to John, I thought it was really interesting when he said that Bellingham's, one of the big things for Bellingham is he knows he'll get his game at Liverpool, which he doesn't have the same certainty of around Real Madrid. And that might be weird given how good he is, Steve. But I do think that's a thing for all these players. That is likely to be a thing that they're going to be about.
Yeah, I think so. I think, especially when it comes to Jude Bellingham, I think he seems to have a very good team around him. His family mainly, his dad seems to have a very level head on his shoulders. And his career seems to have been planned very well to this point. Obviously, he went to Dortmund because he knew he was going to get game time, he was going to develop. And then when the time was right, he was going to move back to the Premier League or abroad or whatever his next step was. And it seems like he wants to come back to the Premier League, hopefully to Liverpool. So that seems to be planned very well. You know, it's again, I listened to the same show that Adam did, really enjoyed it. It's mainly to listen to you trying to pronounce the name Stefan Batatic. That was quite funny.
A lot of graft.
I hope he stays around for a long time, just the way you say that over and over. But it does feel like it could have all been planned. The whole thing could be coming together nicely. You know, there could be a lot of purpose to the reasons why Liverpool didn't strengthen in the summer. Because there has been the eyes on these two sort of really exciting players that could be coming in. And again, like Phil's theory on Benfica saying, well, we probably wanted both of Benfica in the summer. They said, we want to keep Fernandes for a bit longer. So if you hang on, we'll put his buyout clause at 120 million quid, but come the summer, you can have him for a little bit less. So good theories. I do like them. I'm trying to be honest not to get carried away too much, but it's Christmas, so it's hard not to.
It's hard not to. I'll circle back around to Amrabat, because if Amrabat happens, Sean, it feels as though it happened in the short term. But the one thing I would say is the Amrabat link in amongst these other two with Bellingham and Fernandes. And even if it is just, in inverted commas, Bellingham Fernandes, what it strikes me as is that, you know, with the continued development / new contract with Elliot and Jones, the likely departures are along with Wijnaldum and Lallana already being done, going back a couple of years. It's therefore absolutely certain that Liverpool would have a very different midfield outlook than 2019-20 if they were to do either literally Bellingham and Fernandes or things that were Bellingham and Fernandes-y. And I think that tactically, Sean, I think it marks a bit of a departure on the one hand, but on the other hand, it just sort of marks the next phase of Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool.
Yes, it seems like you are moving towards more of a situation where you don't just have three midfielders, where you might end up with four or five midfielders that are just completely multifunctional, and then a couple of maybe more specialist players within the squad that give you a bit of horses for courses element to that. So you know, you might have someone who would be more of an eight or a 10, maybe a bit more attacking, a bit more dynamic perhaps, and you might have someone who's a bit more really defensive and would have to be an outline six. But I wonder whether they're moving towards everyone being an eight that could do six or could develop into a six if you wanted them to. Possibly that's the reason why, along with what you said with the World Cup comments, that Amrabat just seems a really weird link at the moment. It's more of a Julio Benitez type signing where, you know, you might pick him up cheaper than you thought you may have done. And, you know, after a World Cup and worst case scenario, might be a good squad player and things like that. Whereas I think with Liverpool, you get the impression that they'd be very much looking at a younger age profile, possibly for one. And in addition to that, you might be looking at, in terms of not just resale value, but also what we've just been discussing there in terms of being an all-round player. Amrabat, very defensive. He's been around a bit. When he was at Hellas Verona, they defended their way. Like, that's a real Julio Benitez type, loving for a plucky underdog that just absolutely dogs the way. I don't know if they qualified for Europe in the end, but they looked like they might do at one point. And he was a big part of that. I know he's at Fiorentina now, but with that link, there's a whole hoax of questions about whether he would be suitable. The only thing he would say is in that right age profile where there's a bit of a gap in the Liverpool squad between the youngsters and the players who are getting on a little bit. And if you were looking for someone to maybe just fill that void between 22 and 29, you know, and someone who can play a six, maybe you'd have a look at that. But I think more so with Bellingham and the links with Enzo Fernandez, if you said in 5 years' time you groom them to be a six, you could believe it. They're absolutely outstanding eights right now. They obviously have a high ceiling. Everyone in Europe's going to love them. Everyone in Europe's going to want them. With Enzo Fernandez in particular, going to sell him. They won't be moving to it'll come to what he believes his career trajectory should be. So ultimately what I'm saying is Jurgen Klopp needs to do a few trips to Blackpool. he's probably already had Bellingham on the Big Dipper, but we maybe need to introduce Enzo Fernandez to the delights of Blackpool Lights and get Klopp charming him.
Just, I'll come back to you, Sean, on this idea of 3-8s. This to me feels like the perfect marriage of what Klopp's done to date and what he may well want to go on to do. I think there's no, for me, if you take one thing from the last 2 years of the way Liverpool have approached games and how they've looked to change the way in which they play, it's felt to me as though there is a desire to find a way to get one more on the pitch who may well create something and make something happen for you. But I just sort of wonder whether or not Liverpool are maybe better served with the idea of upping the creativity from the midfield three by 33% per man, upping the likely goal return from the midfield three by 33% per man, rather than have the idea of how do we get one more attacker on. I think that's in part because the nature of the fullbacks and what they offer and how you don't want to lessen them in an ideal world in there as well. The nature of Salah is very different to, for instance, the players Manchester City have in wide areas and tend to use in wide areas. I just sort of wonder whether or not that may well be Liverpool's way home, rather than looking at trying to find a way to get a lad who's a bit more of a what we could call a 10 in, use him as an 8, but accept the swings and roundabouts of that.
Yeah, if you look back to even Lallana and Wijnaldum, they, for other clubs, they could easily have played as a 10 or as a left-sided wide player drifting inside. And Wijnaldum obviously with more physical strength, but Lallana's defensive work in terms of his pressing and work rate, game intelligence, everything that came with that, meant that they were able to play as 2-8s in a Klopp 4-3-3. Something that we spoke about on the review, that it seems like Liverpool's recruitment and squad, for me, has moved a bit away from that sort of physical strength, maybe pace, explosivity, perhaps. And something you definitely get with Bellingham and Enzo Fernandez, you're not signing two Harvey Elliotts, are you? And if there is one thing about Harvey Elliott and Curtis Jones, that you could say maybe they'll progress and start hitting bigger numbers in terms of their work with the ball. I think everyone expects that Harvey Elliott's very good at pressing, but both of them have to get a lot better without the ball, Curtis Jones included. You look at Enzo Fernandez's stats, quite good at tackling, but I think he's very much more with the ball kind of exciting than without. Similar with Bellingham, but I think Liverpool will feel, a bit like Thiago said, Klopp taught me how to run. You get the feeling that Liverpool will feel, we get these one, both of these in, or players of that type in, if they've got the right physical presence, physical attributes, and more importantly, the technical ability, they can teach the rest, they can coach the rest. I think the culture of the dressing room gets you embedded into everything else. So, yes, I'm glad that we're being linked, whether we get them or not, with players that have that physical presence and power and pace. Because I think against Napoli, I think we're a more technically we're a better side. But at times, Napoli just bullied us. And when you were actually watching them live up close, the sheer difference in size was mad. It was like the old Chelsea teams come on against some of our Liverpool teams. And I do think Liverpool need to start recruiting the technical players, but also the power and the pace.
The other thing that can happen around sort of power and pace, Adam, is I think that Liverpool do need to find a way through to being in better position to pick the games for Thiago Henderson, maybe even Fabinho to an extent, because I think it'll help prolong careers. You know, the five subs feels like it's here to stay, and we're going to talk about that a little bit in part four. But for me, the sooner we can get these footballers into squad rotation roles, the better it is for them and for us, and the more likely it is we're talking about these footballers in the form of Thiago and Henderson still conceivably having 3-4 more years being able to play at the highest level for Liverpool. but not if they're both asked to do 50 games a season. That's where we may have a little bit of a problem. And that's something which, you know, another reason to bring in the footballers that we've been linked with is because we do need to find a way to lessen the burden on the footballers we currently have.
Yeah, and I think that's it. It's not, it isn't just about prolonging their careers, though. That's obviously good if we could get another, as you say, 3 or 4 years out of Henderson and Thiago, but also getting them at their best. You know, Jordan Henderson didn't have a great start to the season. I mean, I think there were loads of mitigating reasons for that, but he didn't. And so it's all well and good saying, oh, we're able to play him. But when you're playing him every week, he's not at his best because he's older. You know, that is just the way life works, you know, and it's the reason there aren't any 40-year-olds playing.
It's not just every week, Adam. I think it's worth saying it's every 3 days. Yeah. And that's not going to stop anytime soon, both this season, but also in seasons to come. The burden on the players is only going one way, whether the manager likes it or not, we like it or not, it's only going one way.
Yes, exactly that. And I think you saw actually I didn't see because I didn't watch it, but I've heard people talk of his performance in the World Cup when he was brought in originally by Southgate, that he basically ran the show in the match that England played. And he hadn't played for ages. Like, there's a reason he was so good, because he hadn't played for ages. Whereas for us, everyone, you know, there's a lot of people that don't like Jordan Henderson and that they're able to point to things and go, oh, he was shit in this match or shit in that match. Well, part of the reason is his legs have gone, because he's, you know, he's older and he's basically spent his career being a box-to-box midfielder, and then all of a sudden he can't run in the same way anymore. That you're just limited when you get older. It's just true. You know, that's just a fact, unfortunately, that we all have to face. But so if you bring in these other midfielders that can do the running, and you replace people that might be very talented but ultimately have disappointed in terms of being able to get onto the pitch, like Naby Keita, and you replace them with somebody who can get onto the pitch on a regular basis, then you're giving players who are older a little bit of time for the manager to pick and choose which games they play in, or take them off after an hour, or do any number of other things that prolongs their ability to play at the top level. And that's what we want from them. So right now we're basically having to pick a midfield of Henderson, Thiago and Fabinho, because everybody else has been injured. So the manager hasn't got a lot of choice. So giving choice and letting him say, right, I'll play Henderson for an hour, Thiago for half an hour, and won't even play Fabinho until next week, that lets everybody be a little bit fresher for every game.
The reason why, Steve, I think if there is something in the Amrabat bits and pieces, is because I think that right now Liverpool's outlook would be, if they could bring someone in to lessen the burden on Fabinho, it simultaneously will lessen the burden on Henderson. You're lessening the burden on Henderson, you can pick Henderson's games a little bit smarter, you can pick Fabinho's games a little bit smarter, and you've got someone else who's relatively reliable for the foreseeable future. That, to me, is the strongest argument for moving into an Amrabat way, that it's almost, in an oddly Liverpool way, it's almost a six-month solution. But that it's a critical 6 months, both for the future of the club in terms of making sure we retain the Champions League status, but also if you're going to start being able to protect Henderson, protect Thiago, to an extent protect Fabinho, you've got to almost start doing it now. Now would be a good time to start doing it. And the way the world looks after the World Cup is a bit up in the air. And that's why I think if there is something in the Amrabat thing, I feel as though it's in that general direction.
Yeah, it's a very strange link. I mean, I'm very, very cautious about buying players from the World Cup, especially after a good World Cup. We've been burnt by that before. However, I do think he's looked really good. He's very, very workable. Like, just a proper, the engine on him is ridiculously good. And when you see some of the ground, he covers. And he's quite quick over the ground as well. You do see how he'd be attractive to us and the things he could bring to the side. Something that we lack, a bit of aggression at times, I think. Just really playing that front foot, leading the press from the midfield, really got that energy to get up there. So if he is available, you know, last 6 months left in his contract, I believe, I think he would be ready for not too much money. Well, whatever not too much money is these days, I think 30 million quid touted around. I could see why it wouldn't make a lot of sense for us. I think he's interesting. I thought he was excellent last night against France. I thought he was one of the best players on the pitch for Morocco. I thought he put himself about his... Tackling Mbappe in the second half was fantastic. So, yeah, I certainly think he will bring something to that side, or to our current squad and side that we lack a bit at the moment. So it would be interesting to see if this one pans out.
The other part of this, for me, Sean, it was interesting to see the use of Bajcetic. I'll go with that for now. There's also Morton on loan, and Clark played in the game against Lyon. I'm intrigued by, firstly, where they view his trajectory at, but also in amongst, as we sort of talked about before, Liverpool having a very different midfield outlook, quite possibly from the start of next season onwards. And I think that that is the reality of it. And I feel like Bacetic in particular has got a role to play in amongst all of that. But I think he's closer to pretty regular first team football than we may think.
Yeah, the conversation just having then about relieving a bit of the stress of Fabinho and Henderson, I wonder whether the next 6 months in the short term is a huge audition for Bacetic to try and convince, and we obviously don't know to what level they need convincing, but perhaps convincing the powers that be that he's the person that could do 10 to 20 starts if you had the luxury of cherry picking where you drop him in. And that's the problem, because you could have a situation where going away to Manchester City with no Jordan Henderson, no Fabinho, and you're not cherry picking all of a sudden, and you need to make a decision as to who you're putting in that situation. The other question with Bacetic is how much he fills into his frame playing in that position, because whether you like it or not, the smaller and the weaker you are in that role, the better technically you have to be and the better you have to be at reading the game to sort of make up for them. And you're also, especially for Liverpool, you're firefighting a lot in that role. And we've seen it with Fabinho, that, like, they call him the lighthouse, don't they? But the areas that he has to cover, it's extremely physically demanding for him. And he's got to prove that he can do that. But from, you know, ever since he signed for the club, they've raved about him, saying he's years ahead of what he does. Even against Leon, there's a lot of things they could have done with Nat Phillips, James Milner, Gomez could have played a different position. They've been pretty committed to pressing, to working on that in Dubai and putting him in that role. I think tactically you can see a lot of the things that he does are what we've seen Fabinho and Henderson doing. So it'll be interesting. I don't know what you guys think. I think there's a chance that Liverpool go, he's the person that means we get, assuming we don't have to sell Fabinho to raise funds or anything like that, he might be the person that Liverpool go, no, we can get 10, 20 starts out of him next season. We think he's moving towards that level or is at that level, so that we don't have to do quite as much surgery as perhaps we do. Because if they decide that he's another year or two away or needs a loan, I think you do need to bring someone in to fulfill that exact role, because who in the squad would do that for you? You're struggling, really. Even Tyler Morton, they've said, we had a little look at him at a six, he's not that, and he isn't. I'm not sure whether he'd be Liverpool quality, but I think he'd be a good professional player as an eighth. I don't know what you guys think, but I think unless Bacetic does fulfil that audition, you have to bring someone in to fulfil that role.
Steve, that is it's the oddness of trying to sort of manage a squad, and that's why I've always got sympathy for managers in this situation. I get the impression that if Liverpool were either absolutely guaranteed top four on the one hand, or on the other hand, were in a position where top four didn't matter, I reckon they'd probably gamble on the young lad a little bit in the second half of the season and see where he ends up. That's not the reality that we live in. It's not the reality where we are. And that is what I think puts the pressure on the manager and on everyone at the club to make these sorts of decisions.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult, isn't it? Because we haven't had the greatest start. So the pressure's going to be really on. So every point's going to be vital in the second half of the season to make sure we get that top four, to push on as much as we can. It's not a great draw in the League Cup. We would have liked someone a bit more straightforward so we can get more game time there. But we've got Wolves in the FA Cup again, which isn't a great draw, but I think he'll definitely play in that game.
He's definitely playing that game.
100%, yeah. Yeah, I'm joking, aren't you? my boot's got more dust on than anything. They obviously really rate him. There's a lot of buzz around him, a lot of good noise around him. Tyler Morton, again, is another one who's doing really well at Blackburn. I'm sure mentioned him then, but I'm not too sure he's a six, as he said. With all these links to these midfield players, Sean just touched then. I wonder if there's just a little bit in the Fabinho rooms. I've seen a little bit of Fabinho links to Atletico Madrid and a couple of other places. That for me, just might have a little bit of substance to it. I'm not saying obviously losing another midfield wouldn't be ideal, but bringing someone like Enzo in, if you got him in, bringing someone like Amrabat in as well, and with Bacetic coming through, maybe that has got some legs, I don't know. That's one I've kind of seen a little bit of thoughts. I've seen him get a couple of dressing downs off Klopp on the touchline. His legs don't look as good as they used to be. Maybe he'll look abroad and go, maybe a bit of a league that isn't as physical, isn't as quick, might suit him better. So That's certainly one I'll be keeping an eye over the summer, I think.
Okay, coming up, if you listen to this as a podcast, you have got Josh speaking to Danny Sharples about a charity gig being organised for an hour for others. Also, in addition, there's me speaking to Michael McCambridge about the death of Grant Wall. That is to come in a second or two. Also, to point out, it is the last day to get merchandise for UK deliveries before Christmas from the Anfield Wrap. If you go to shop.theanfieldwrap.com, we'll get them in for you and get them boxed off as quickly as we can and get stuff out to anyone who wants it for any degree of Christmas present. Loads of really good stuff in the Anfield Wrap shop. It is all limited edition. Stuff will not be getting reprinted, if that's the word. Is that what you do with T-shirts? You reprint them. I think you knit the hats in some way, shape, or form. Reissued, says Andy, marvellous stuff. Indeed. Also, an Anfield Wrap shout out in a couple of things. First and foremost, to everyone who's had to take the awful step of stepping forward on strike action this week. Huge amounts of sympathy in the comments around that as well, being pointed out in there as well. And we want to say hello to Michael Laffey, who, as a friend of the show, or more accurately, his dad is as well. He's got his first contract this week, and we're absolutely delighted that that has happened. Huge congratulations to him from a Liverpool point of view. All fabulous stuff indeed. This has been part one of Tour Live coming up. You've got in there as well. We've got Michael McCambridge in a second or two. We've got Danny Sharples. That has been part one of Tour Live this week. I'm joined by Michael McCambridge to talk about a person who we could refer to as our mutual friend, in that I know Grant Wall because Michael put him in touch with me. And Grant went on to write the foreword for the book that Michael and I wrote together called Red Letters. Michael obviously has known him for a great deal longer. It's hard really to put into words, Michael, and I was both surprised and then when one stopped to rationalise and understand it, the extent of the outpouring of emotion around Grant passing away so tragically and so early in his life. What I mean by that is, obviously, as a journalist around football, you do at times, I'm sure we all have in different ways, wondered who's actually listening, who's actually reading and so on and so forth. But with Grant, there was a real world impact that his work had for an extended period of time on an entire nation and the way in which it perceived soccer/football. And the depth of the outpouring makes sense hugely in that context.
Yeah, and I think that if you're an American and you've been here, you understand that. But it is really difficult to explain to someone in another country the degree and the enormity of influence that Grant had. There really, I was searching my mind before we, because I knew we were going to talk today. There's really no analog in English media. I think the closest thing I've come up with is Grant Wall was to soccer in America like what Julia Child was to French cuisine in America. I mean, he was the person who, for a staggeringly large percentage of the population, introduced the sport and writing about the sport and the ins and outs of the sport. And at the time that he started covering the sport for Sports Illustrated in the 90s, there was still this tremendous pushback against the idea that soccer was in any way a legitimate sport in the United States. And so you had this widespread idiocy of people literally in Congress saying the sport was inherently communist because you couldn't use your hands. You had announcers saying that, you know, the sport was un-American and boring. And well, of course, sometimes it can be boring, but you had this, tremendous pushback in America. And Grant, because he was not, I mean, there'd certainly been influential soccer writers in America before, but mostly they were expats, people like Paul Gardner, who came over here and wrote about the sport. Grant was All-American boy, went to Princeton, wrote about college basketball, wrote the first big national magazine piece on LeBron James. And so he was somebody whose American sporting credentials were solid, but he, you know, I think he left during, he went away during college to write a long thesis about the culture of football in Argentina. And he just, like a lot of Americans, grew to love the game. And he became a champion of soccer in America without ever being an apologist for soccer in America. And so, as we've seen over the last generation, really since USA 94, as we've seen the sport growing and growing and growing, and that American soccer audience becoming more and more literate, Grant has been the most authoritative voice, the conscience of the sport, somebody who showed people the ins and outs and how it worked and how often how it didn't work, and more recently, how corruptly it worked.
There is, when you talk about Grant has shown people and the work that he'd done for soccer in the United States, there's something around the work that Grant, the way Grant was held, the esteem he was held in by his peers and his colleagues in the United States, and the work that he did, for instance, I read a very moving thread about him effectively looking to find work for people who'd been laid off by Sports Illustrated, that he was someone who was not just deemed to be, firstly, good at what he did, but also, secondly, he was very much seen to be somebody who was one of the good people, the people who tried to be as inclusive as possible, tried to get as many different types of people involved, not just in soccer, but also in journalism in the United States as possible, very much wanted to get as many different sorts of types of voices involved in the conversation as humanly possible. And that appears to, be another facet as to why his loss has been and will continue to be so keenly felt.
Yes, he was always very approachable, and he was always game, to your point, for the idea of expanding the sort of games that people would see and also the sort of people that could write and talk about the games. And so he was a champion of the U.S. women's national team even before they broke through in the 1999 Women's World Cup. And he was also assiduous about trying to get as many different voices, people of color, minorities, women, into the soccer conversation, so it wasn't all just people like us, middle-aged white guys.
As part of that, this is sort of speaks to who he is and who he was, what he was about. And, you know, as I say, my contact with him, he came to the studio a couple of times, did a couple of different bits and pieces with him. He does the foreword for the book. We did the event together with him, which was, you know, I was genuinely pleased to do, because one of the things that struck me was, firstly, he was funny. He was excellent company. He was pleased to be around. He was very pleased to see people doing well. He was very, very inquisitive. I liked him a great deal in the short period of time that I got to meet him. And I think it's important to not to separate the achievements and the person, but to be crystal clear about the fact that the person was part of why the achievements happened in the way in which they did. And you said to me, when you messaged me about this in the first place, one of the things that broke your heart about him passing away was the fact that him and his wife Celine were, in your words, one of your favorite couples. This sadness is genuinely as much about the personality as it was the work.
Yeah, on my infrequent trips to New York, I would often have dinner with Grant and Celine, and they were one of those couples that it almost delighted Grant how little Celine cared about the world of soccer, how utterly indifferent she was about what he spent so many hours a day eating, sleeping, and drinking, and he was so proud of the work she did. She is, you know, one of the most renowned voices in public health in America. And she's done great work with public health in like townships in Soweto in South Africa and on Indian reservations. And there is no question in my mind that in addition to, them being a wonderful influence on each other, that the sort of yeoman, indefatigable work that Grant did covering the inequities and injustice in soccer, like this long piece he did interviewing migrant workers in Qatar about how they were treated in the buildup to this World Cup, that he was inspired to do that just because he wanted to live up to the example that Celine set. And it was one of the great things about him, that he was just tireless and always enthusiastic. And when he came down here in September, he was talking about the first part of what he called the Qatar Chronicles coming out. And he'd spent so much time. He didn't just come into Qatar and talk to a few people. There are like 14 FIFA-sanctioned hotels in Doha. And Grant made it a point to go to each one of those and interview at least one migrant worker in every one of those 14 hotels, guaranteeing them anonymity, to get down to how they were treated, when they came here, how much they get paid, where is their passport, can they get their passport back, could they work at another job. And he sort of humanized the human rights abuses for not just an American audience, but a broader audience as well.
Last thing, because we could both get upset and we need to not do that, but there is something about the next World Cup. I saw Grace Robertson tweeted something that it's almost shocking in a way that the next World Cup will be in the United States and Grant won't be there to cover it. And it is, okay. That's interesting in terms of the fact that it's quite possible, and you don't want to overstate, but there may not actually be the next World Cup in the United States if there hadn't been for Grant, full stop, because of the work that he'd done around the game and pushing the game for such an extended period of time. It seems to me as though, you know, the legacy is absolutely enormous, but given Grant's relatively young age, the losses, are there another generation of American voices? Is there American voices around the game ready to step into the space that Grant leaves? Because it seems to me as though he led so boldly around all of this. There's lots and lots of really good, intriguing, insightful American commentators on soccer/football. But there is a difference, as I know, quite emphatically, there is a difference between journalism and soccer. And, sorry, between journalism and commentary. Mm-hmm. And it does feel to me as though, you know, Grant was the pioneering sort of US journalist. I know you teach a class on the World Cup, you teach classes on journalism on a regular basis. You're very well placed to sort of answer this. You know, is American media ready to find a way to have that voice somewhere else within the American landscape?
I think there are other voices, and there are other voices that Grant has raised up, and other people who can write intelligently and informatively about soccer. I don't think there will ever be in American soccer one person with the authority and the connections. I mean, this is somebody who in 2010, when he finally understood just how corrupt FIFA was, who went around the world and himself ran to be FIFA president, on kind of a lark, but just to sort of underscore what awful people these were running the federation that governed this wonderful sport. And so there are people out there who will follow in his footsteps. And he was somebody who promoted many of these people. But to find one person with all the connections, with all the experience, with the institutional memory that he had from going to every one of these USA World Cup qualifiers in Panama and Honduras and Jamaica. And he went, just to give one example, and then I'll stop my filibuster. He went once to cover a USA World Cup qualifier in Honduras. And he actually had arranged to interview the president of Honduras. And about 30 minutes before the interview, Grant was held up and robbed at gunpoint in Honduras. And, you know, gave up his keys and his wallet and his phone and everything else. And 30 minutes later was introduced to the president of Honduras. How are you doing? Well, I was fine, but I was just robbed at gunpoint. but he was somebody who would go to those places and write back and show Americans the full texture and range of experiences in this sport.
Excellent stuff from Michael. It's been intriguing to see the nature of the outpouring from a number of different people and a number of different ways. It seems as though, you know, ultimately this was someone who wanted to open the world up to people and wanted to tell their stories in as dramatic a way as possible. I was pleased that Michael introduced Grant into my life, so thank you very much to him. Thank you very much for listening to this part of this show. We'll get on now with Josh, but thanks to Michael for taking the time to talk to us about Grant.
And it is Josh Sexton for Tour Live. I'm delighted to be joined now by Danny Sharpauser. You may recognise the surname is Brother Ben from Mike Lowry. He's been on Anfield Rap podcast before, speaking with me in particular. But I saw a thing on Ben's story about his brother Danny, which we'll sort of come on to talk about. But Danny, first of all, thank you for coming on the Anfield Rap. If you could just tell us a little bit about your background and why you wanted to do what you are doing to the audience.
Thanks for having me, man. background, I'm a musician too. Nowhere near as famous as Ben. Kind of annoying since I'm the older brother who taught him everything he knows, but yeah. You know,
at least you're not bothered about it.
Yeah, no, not so. Nothing so. Depends on the day. But yeah, I do. I'm a musician too. I try to put on a charity gig at least once a year to raise some funds for a charity that I approve of. And this year we're going to do an hour for others, a Liverpool-based charity who, it kind of echoes how I feel about charity work. Like, it doesn't have to necessarily be anything huge and grandiose. It's just about using what you have available to you in order to give back and to inspire other people to do the same. So yeah, we're going to try and raise some funds and awareness for those guys.
And I'm just looking at the Just Giving page here, and I believe you've got a background doing charity work as well. Is that right? Or is it just the charity concerts that have sort of been the basis of that?
Yeah, I work for a charity called Hobie UK, which is we provide youth leadership workshops and seminars for 14 to 18 year olds. That's also based in the Northwest. There's a bit of a family theme going. So me dad is actually the CEO of.
All right, okay. I'll have to get him on soon then as well.
Keep the family theme going. But I've been working for those guys for about 4 years. Smaller roles to start with, and nowadays I'm their director of communications. So I look after their website and their social media and stuff like that. Awesome charity. And in fact, we're going to take the donations through that charity because Hobie UK is registered with Just Giving. It means that we can take the gift aid donations, which, it tops up whatever you can offer through a tax relief.
Yeah, so people will be able to find out more about this on the Just Giving page. It's justgiving.com/fundraising/DannySharples1. But just tell us a little bit about why an hour for others. We there'll be a few people who listen to this who aren't familiar with the charity, probably not even local to Liverpool either. So why this charity specifically?
I think it's just a fantastic idea. It comes from a good place. That the founder, Kevin Morland, set it up, I think it was in 2014. Basically, the idea being that we all have something to offer, whether it just be your time or whether it be a specific skill set. And if you can donate a little bit of that time and a little bit of that skill set to people in need, then we can make the world a better place. Kevin himself has a background in painting and decorating. So he'll go to the homes of maybe the elderly, maybe some of the less well-off. He's redecorated bedrooms and classrooms and these kind of things. And just by him giving up 3 or 4 hours a week, he's changing lives and inspiring others to do the same, which I guess is what I try to do with these charity gigs. I have that skill set and I can put something on and hopefully help by doing so.
Yeah, I can only echo what you've said about an Hour for Others charity there. A fantastic charity doing great work for people in the city in particular. And so what can we expect from this gig of yours? And you've done a couple to this point. Is it getting bigger and better every year? Jay-Z and Beyonce headlining.
you don't need them when you've got me. Yeah, man, it's been getting better. I've been based out of Liverpool for about 13 years now. So the gig is actually down in London. And to be honest, because the charity I've chosen this year is a lesser known charity, and perhaps because it's a Liverpool based one, I'm not sure. It has been a bit more of a struggle to generate funds this time. Last year we did it for the RNLI, which is obviously a much wider known charity. We did another one for Crisis, which is the homeless charity. With more of a national appeal. So I definitely need the people of Liverpool to get behind me this time and try and bump up those donations for sure.
So the gig we're speaking of is on the 15th of December, I think I'm right in saying. So it'll be tomorrow, I think, as this podcast goes out, or the 16th of December, isn't it?
Yeah.
The podcast is going out on the 15th. That's where I'm getting confused with the dates. So yeah, it's this Friday. If there's anyone listening to this from London, what's the address for the place to go and watch this?
We're going to be headed to Venn Street Records, which is in Clapham. and it's always lively in there anyway. So even if you just want to come and have a dance and lend your good vibes towards the charity, then feel free. But obviously, we would be very appreciative of any donations that you could offer to. We'll be taking donations throughout the month. So even after the gig has passed and been a huge success, Jay-Z, Beyonce passed free. we're still going to take a few.
They didn't make the billing for this one.
They're the special surprises, you know. You come because you want to offer something, and then you get something back, you know.
Yeah. So if you are in the Clapham area, Venn Street Records, make sure you do get down there. But as I say before, the Just Giving link is justgiving.com/fundraising/DannySharples1. I just want to say well done to you, Danny, as well for putting this on. It's obviously, you know, good that you've got a background in charity work, but you know, we mentioned the sort of concept of an hour for others there, and the idea that we've all got something to offer. So for the fact that you've, you know, got the background in charity work, but then the background in music, and to pull those two things together is great, really, and doing great things for a great charity. So everyone listening to this, if you're not familiar with An Hour for Others, make sure you go and find out more information about them. Make sure you go to Danny's page to donate as well, especially because, you know, we're this is the Northwest, we're, you know, the Scousers listening to this. We want to make sure that Northwest Scouse charity gets a boost from this gig in London, don't we? So we'll go down there and blow them all out the water. But nice one, Danny, for coming on. Nice one for telling us more about the charity, and nice one for all your great work as well, mate.
And Kev and the team at An Hour for Others told me to say hello as well. Apparently you've always been big champions of them, so they're very grateful.
Oh, nice one, mate. Appreciate it. Yeah, shout out to Kev and An Hour for Others as well. As I said before, a great charity, doing great work. That's been this segment of Tour Life.
And now we're in part four. It happens ever so quickly these days, that sort of thing. Just had a phone call from me, Dad. Dad, I'm Tour Live. It's happening right now. Come on. Obviously not watching on the YouTube, unless he's got something to really offer on this merch question and wants to launch himself in and have a thing or two to say. It is 24:58, and we will be there from that. In the comments in our private chat that we have, Adam Smith has pointed out that he can't believe I didn't get the black hoodie memo. It is the contributors' Christmas party tonight, gentlemen. I hope all three of you are coming. I have dressed to impress. If you're coming, you need to up your game a little bit. We'll crack on with go on, Adam.
We look like your backing dancers, Neil.
We'll take that all day, and we'll go from there. I'm not quite sure the quality of the choreography, but we'll see where we all end
up.
I want to talk about the World Cup only in the context of, I don't want to do the political bits and pieces because they've been done elsewhere by people better qualified, people who are out there who've done a good job. I'm thinking specifically there of Miguel Delaney and Adam Crafton, but other people have done really, really well as well. Time going by, Sean, what happened to the World Cup in a tactical sense would often be spoken about, but I think in the last few World Cups, I think you can even mark it to an extent from Italia 90 in a strange way, slowly but surely. It's felt like questions around the rules has actually become more significant. So, for instance, Italia 90, tackles from behind and the back pass rule are sort of precipitated by that World Cup. This one, it feels to me like there's two things that I think are really, really significant for the game moving forward. One is the time-wasting question. And the other thing that appears, it just sort of struck me the other day whilst I was looking, reflecting on some World Cup bits and pieces that I had seen, is that it feels like five subs has just become embedded and unquestioned now in the game. I don't quite see a way back from five subs at this stage. It was only meant to be brought in this year in the Premier League for 1 year. I just cannot see how five subs now is reversed.
I agree on the five subs thing as well, because you've got so many different variations and bodies that ultimately through greed are all just trying to keep shoehorning more and more in. You get the feeling that they might just keep the five subs up their sleeve, make out that they want to get rid of it and say, okay, well, I'll tell you what, you have to let them things go, but we'll keep the five subs. And therefore it helps you out both during games and then in terms of rotation and everything else. In terms of the stoppage time, I've been in the sort of, not as big a cheerleader, but I don't think anyone can be as big a cheerleader as Phil Blundell on anything, to be fair to him. But I've very much been in that camp that if you can't tell the time and get that right, you're not going to get anything else right on the pitch, which unfortunately we see quite a lot of. And when you compare it to other sports, the timekeeping element is a joke. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well. Because as much as the time gets added on, I don't know how you put a value in terms of breaking another team's momentum.
Yeah.
Whereas T thought in the past it's been called tasting because it genuinely did work. I think we're going to do it. And it's what the referees do to enforce it. Because in the past, the referees would be a bit more, no, get up, hurry on. I'm maybe going to book you for time wasting. But when you're in a situation where you'll add on 7 minutes at the end or 9 minutes on the end or 11, I'd be saying to the ref, don't be threatening to book me. Just add it on. What's the big deal? There's no time wasting here. I honestly have, you know, done my ankle or whatever. You know, Newcastle will have their whole team going down with head injuries throughout, won't they? And like you say, it's not the old days where you'd probably see more tactical things coming out of World Cups, one for the kids, that really. Obviously, the domination of European football and Champions League and then the main Super Leagues themselves, they obviously set the trend in terms of the tactical sides to it. And it'll be very interesting to see as well how each, well, not just UEFA, but how each league decides to address not just the five source, but particularly the time wasting element, and then whose role it would be also within each league to do that job. Because you wouldn't have the men in the middle doing that, would you? You'd have, whether it be VAR or whoever else, taking over that role.
It seems to me, Steve, that we are looking at, you know, I think that the time wasting is going to almost be the biggest long-term takeaway, or more accurately, the time added on. And I agree with Sean. I don't think it'll necessarily lead to an end in time wasting. I think the five subs actually plays into the idea of part of what sides are looking to do is retain freshness and will feel as though they can retain freshness. It's as much about rest, as much about kill the opposition's momentum and so on and so forth, the breaks in play. But that said, I think we will see over the course of the Christmas period a couple of big halves of injury time in the Premier League before everyone then rows back and works out where it is that they want to be.
Hopefully. I mean, yes. I mean, as you know, Sean alluded to the Newcastle game, which started this season, which was just, you know, literally from the second minute, they were wasting time and it was just non-stop. And it wasn't, as we know, it's not just to waste time, it's just to kill momentum, to get rhythm. Liverpool team are a team that thrive on playing quick football, momentum, tempo. And the more you can stop the game, the more you're going to disrupt that. So it's not necessarily because they were drawn 0-0 or they wanted to win the game and they just wanted to kill our momentum. So no matter how much time you add on, they're just going to keep going down and get more and more time. As long as it's stopping us play football, that's just going to keep doing what they're doing. I think one of the main things I took away from the World Cup is the referees. Some of the refereeing, the performance I've seen in the World Cup have been absolutely terrible again. Mm. So it's not just a theme that runs through the Premier League, but it's certainly something that runs throughout football. I mean, the England-France game being the main point, he was literally one of the worst referees I think I've ever seen. Some of the decisions he was making, backed up by VAR, and everyone says this is going to improve the game. I think VAR needs massive work in some of the rules and interpretation still. But I think hopefully things can move forward. The time wasting thing, as I said, is a massive bugbear in mine. But I just don't see how adding more time at the end is going to improve that, really. I think unless the clock is externally controlled by VAR and they stop the clock when the ball goes out, stop the clock when the subs go down. Subs are made, but again, that's not going to stop people doing it. It's just going to, again, because they just want to kill the momentum of the game. So it'd be interesting to see how it pans out for the Premier League.
I know you've chosen not to watch the World Cup, which is perfectly reasonable. I'm of the view where that's a little bit sad, and it's not about your choice. It's more about the fact that some people will be choosing not to watch the World Cup, is that there's a bit of an end of an era around this. A number of players, I think Messi is obviously the prime example, but Luka Modric is another example. I think there's every chance that Jordan Henderson retires from international football. He may choose to run to the next Euros, but I think there's a chance that there's a fair few players, and especially given the pandemic, the way this hung over, there was the Euros in 2021. So there wasn't a big gap between the Euros in 2021 and this World Cup to sort of encourage some players to hang on. It wouldn't surprise me if it's, for a number of players, this is their last dance. And therefore, it makes me sort of feel a bit sad that there's a number of people who felt that they can't actually engage with this because it will be the last opportunity to see a fair few of these players represent their country at the highest level.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, for me, the whole thing's been about the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the corruption and all the other stuff that I've spoken about on other shows. I won't bother repeating that all here. I think the main thing for me has been that sports washing as a concept depends on people saying, I'm just going to ignore that and focus on the football. And I just couldn't do that this time around. I just couldn't say I'm going to focus on the football and watch the games and ignore everything that's going on. So I just didn't watch any of the football. And, you know, it's sad, but at the same time, I don't care. for one thing. For another, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of these players at their best anyway, so I'm not bothered that I'm maybe going to see them at the end of their career. It's almost nicer to hold on to those memories I've got of these players just absolutely bossing it in years gone by. And I think, but the idea, as you say, of kind of a passing of the torch and that sort of thing going on is really interesting, because I'd be amazed if it wasn't Messi's last World Cup, even though looking at the underlying numbers that somebody posted on Twitter before, he's been the best at all of the stuff you'd want him to be the best at. but you still feel like he's unlikely to be there in 4 years' time. Who's going to step up to the plate? That's kind of the question that's going to be interesting to see in 2026. Who is it that said, right, I'm doing, you know, I'm the one that's taking the mantle now? And funnily enough, I was listening to the Unwrapped show that you've done about the players of a certain age, which sounds like I'm being euphemistic, but I mean, within the age bracket that you've done about, you know, there aren't any really within that age bracket that are going to step up and say, I'll be the next best player in the world. Who is going to be the next Messi? Because it isn't going to be him. You know, the good news is it's also not going to be Ronaldo, but who is it going to be that's going to step up and say, this is me, I'm taking that mantle of best player in the world, you know, right now. And that'll be exciting to see. Whilst it's sad to say goodbye to the old guard, everything works in cycles, doesn't it? So there'll be new people coming through that we can get excited about.
There we are, new people to be excited about. Absolutely incredible stuff indeed. Thank you very much to Adam, to Sean, and to Steve, Andy for producing, and everyone who contributed through the show. Always a pleasure. And by that, I sort of just mean Josh, because we'll say thank you explicitly to Michael McCambridge and Danny Sharples as well. Josh will just crack on. He'll be absolutely fine. Everything you need if you download the Anfield Wrap app. And obviously, I've mentioned before about the merchandise last time, to get some really good stuff. It's all in the room there. It's the absolute business, to be honest with you. Get some really good stuff from that. Klopp documentary part 3 will be out next week. 2 was out this week. It was a pleasure to watch that. I've watched the rough cut of 3. Trust me, this is how day by day this is. I watched the rough cut at 3 today. The stuff on Mainz is absolutely incredible in episode 3. It really is. It's the business. So proud of it, and everyone who's worked on it. They've been brilliant, but so have Adam, so Sean, and so Steve. You know what I mean? Everyone's brilliant. It's Christmas, for God's sake. Steve said it before. Whatever you're doing over the weekend, enjoy it. It is the last weekend without football back. To stomp all over your plans and the rest of your life. But let's be clear, we would not have it any other way. Take it easy and see you later. Sports Social Podcast Network.